Good morning, cricket fans, and welcome to the Catch It podcast.
Oh, what a catch!
I'm Andrew Lush, and I started this podcast to have some interesting and insightful conversations about analytics and the stats behind the action, and to develop myself as a presenter.
Good!
Oh, actually, oh, brilliant!
I hope you enjoy our discussions and debates.
That is an absolutely outstanding catch.
Right, James Mabey, welcome to the Catch It podcast and analyst chat. How are you getting on?
Yeah, all good, mate. All good.
Brilliant. How's the winter been for you at Northampton?
I would say slow at times, but that's quite nice because the cricket season can be very busy. And a lot of the players are away in certain franchise comps or just going away and playing some club cricket. But it's nice to have some stability, and it allows us to have lots of planning time and chat with other coaches and kind of go from there.
How did you get into the analysis world in terms of you started in the, we'll go back right to the start, started in education. Tell me a bit about how you moved from working in, you worked in an inner school in Camden. How did you move from working in education to working in analysis?
Yeah, so I did a degree at Bath, and my degree was called Sports and Social Sciences. And in that four-year degree, I had a placement year. And in that placement year, I went and worked at Gloucestershire County Cricket Club as their intern for a year, and that was really formative. I would openly say that I knew nothing about cricket or analysis when I went to uni, but I kind of fell into it. I was like, well, this kind of sounds cool. I'll give this a go for a year. And the rest is history, really. And then because I graduated in 2020 when COVID was, it was a bit of a weird time because no one kind of knew what was going on. And I knew that I enjoyed my year at Gloucester, and I was like, okay, what else can I do? Are there any jobs out there? If there is a job, would they want me? Like, it sometimes feels like a bit of a closed shop to the guys or girls that are from the outside. And then when you kind of get your foot in the door, like, oh, there's loads of things to do. So I managed to blag my way into Surrey and did the academy analysis role, and that was basically just coding and giving some sort of data to the coaches if they ever asked for it. And then in 2022 the Northants job came about, I applied for it, and now we're here. Really,
that's brilliant. Do you think you use any of the skills that you used in the school in Camden in their special needs program? Do you think you use or learned a lot of the skills that you still put into place in your day?
Massively. It was so formative for me. I actually think now when I look at hiring people or getting people on board at Northants, I really like to see some out of industry experience. And I think that for a lot of factors, I think it's really important that you step away from I don't want to say just being a cricketer, but you step away from that kind of environment. And so, for example, being a teaching assistant and sometimes teacher at times, just filling holes and gaps in the school, just standing up in front of people and explaining ideas and explaining thoughts and explaining reasoning is basically what I do now, because I have to try and sell data to coaches. It's a lot easier, I'd say, in my current role, because they want to listen to me. Sometimes they don't, but at the moment they do. And I would say sometimes the children that I was teaching didn't want to listen to me and didn't really have the time of day for me. But you have to learn very quickly on the spot that, okay, you don't want to listen, but I need you to listen. So how am I going to do that? And that was a massive skill that I learned. And I'm still working on it now. It's just trying to find turns of phrases or analogies or putting it into their language so that they understand the information that you're trying to give them.
The soft skill of communication can sometimes be really overlooked when it comes to data analysis. And
it's like the biggest thing for me that I work on with a lot of guys that I'm working with at the moment. When I talk about internships or stuff like that, I'm like, look, you've got the knowledge of cricket. That's not what we're trying to work on here. It's how do you explain what you're seeing to someone that doesn't understand what you're seeing? And that might be through communication, that might be through better visualization, which we'll touch on later, or that might be through better explanation. But ultimately, not everyone knows data, not everyone understands cricket. So you've got to try and make sure that they do understand it.
I can completely understand that. Do you think the fact you've been on Chris Gill's analytics podcast, so talking kind of cricket in a wider context, and then he mainly focuses on football, do you think there's stuff that we as analysts, cricket analysts, can learn from other sports in their data analysis?
Yeah, I think just the way that they talk about the game, I think, is massive. So we were very lucky with the group of coaches that I work with. We went down to Leicester City Football Club, and we had a chat with their academy guys. And it was interesting to see how their processes work and how different sports do things differently. And like, obviously, it's quite strange because cricket is its own game in a lot of ways. We have three different formats, which usually in counties use the same players. We sometimes play for 4 days. We sometimes play for an evening. We sometimes play those games, two types of games in different weeks. And try and explain that to people. They're like, what? They didn't quite understand it.
Well, they have the same format all the way through the year.
Right. And so they talk a lot around build, right, Monday we do this, Tuesday we do this, Wednesday we do this, all ready for Saturday. Sometimes if we have a midweek game on Tuesday, that sometimes changes, but that's rare, especially at the academy level. And everything, all their emotions and their processes are driven around that Saturday afternoon. So with cricket, we don't have that luxury. Sometimes we're playing on Tuesday night, and then we've got to play Wednesday night, then we get a day off Thursday, and then we play Friday afternoon, then we play again Sunday. Like, but that's the nature. That's why it makes it interesting, I suppose, because it's never the same. But when we talk about data and kind of going onto that sort of side of things with football, and I would say they do a lot of work in terms of making sure that the players understand, not only through looking at it, but visually. So it was really interesting to see they in this context that I watched it in, it was they delivered a presentation, a pre-match presentation, and then they walked through what they delivered on the football pitch.
Okay.
And I was like, that's so cool because you've put it all on paper and 99% of players were like, yeah, understand. Yeah, cool. But then when you put it on the pitch, you saw a lot of other moving cracks in terms of, oh, I meant to go there. Oh, okay, right. And I think we kind of do that in cricket in a sense of we're getting better, I suppose, in the winter in terms of I'll put out a bowling plan for, I don't know, bowling to Derby's Wayne Madsen for the spinners. And then I'll speak to the spin coach and I'll go, right, this is a template of what we would look at before a game before we play Derby. This is what Wayne Madsen is very good at. And then the spin coach would use that to work with his bowlers and go, right, if you're bowling to this player, how are you going to counteract this? So we're getting better at plan to strategy to execution, but I think we could do way more than that.
There's kind of a lot more coming into it and how we can breach that gap between just being people on our laptops to them introducing analysis into our actual training sessions. I think one of the points when looking down like your experience and stuff that I really wanted to ask, what is a rugby referee analyst at the Dubai International Invitational Sevens?
Yeah.
What do you do with it?
Yeah, so on my Saturday afternoons, I actually referee rugby myself. And that's kind of how I got into it. And I really enjoy it. And I started when I was 18. I was a bit of a weird one. I was young when I started refereeing. And when you're a referee at my level, you get invited to things and you get invited to tournaments. And I've been lucky enough to say that I've refereed at different tournaments across the world. And I obviously have my day job is being a cricket analyst. And the head of the tournament who runs the referees was very interested in working out a way of how can we help analyze referees? How can we get them better? And it's mainly around referee development. Ultimately, a lot of the referees that would go to a tournament like that are from lots of different countries. And it's brilliant because you'll get loads from South Africa, Australia, like all around the world that play rugby. And we tried a process, a pilot around filming games and then clipping up those games and highlighting good bits of refereeing, not so good bits of refereeing, and trying to help change referees during the tournament because the tournament works around 3 days. So it's brutal. So you start at 8 a.m. and you finish at 9 p.m. and you're refereeing probably around 3 games a day. So there's quite a long period of time where you can video a few games, show a few trends of clips of, okay, we might go into the tent where we all situate and we might have a little meeting at 2 o'clock and go, right, we're refereeing the high tackle really well. Here are some really good examples of clipping out good penalties of high tackles. And then we go, we're not really refereeing the offside lines very well around the breakdown. And that's quite technical rugby speak. Hopefully some people understand that. Or we're not really refereeing this area. Here are some clips of what you should be seeing in your game that you might need to think about penalising. Mm-hmm. Look, was it successful? It worked to a point, but we found a lot of barriers to entry in terms of the mass amount of video. How do we get that video to people? Do we have the right amount of tech and all of that? And so this year, because I did that 2023, this year I ended up just refereeing myself, and a different group of guys did the analysis stuff, and it seemed to work really well. They might be using that to then start live streaming the tournament. They don't know that yet, but it's, again, the tournament has to make money, and they have to get people from across the world to pay and come to the tournament. So the live stream product interests them, because if they could live stream so everyone sees how amazing Dubai Sevens is, you might get more teams going there. So there's loads of things where it could go, but yeah, it's good fun. It's nice to do something a bit different in terms of being in rugby, and nice to kind of see how other people use data and information, because I suppose I worked with a group of people that didn't really use data information and are very used to seeing things and being very visual and going, oh, I do or don't agree with that decision. But actually, when you slowed it down, put it on a video, which they never usually had the luxury of, how does that change perception? How does that change the way that we referee?
Mm-hmm. So in terms of actually giving that video feedback, gives them that different perspective.
Massively, yes.
Because I think that's my interesting point, because I've started filming sessions and stuff over the winter and showing younger players that we've got in the Funder Academy videos of them bowling. And our coaches are really good at collecting video data, but it's just how we store that and then can show that progression. And some of them have never seen them, especially down at like the younger level, the younger players, especially in girls cricket, have never seen themselves on video and stuff. So it's such an interesting feedback loop.
Yes, massively. And I think I would say, I don't know whether you'd agree with this, is that younger players are far more interested in the video. I think I would say there's a big focus on from the academy players that come through. They're very interested in watching all the video, and once you give them the capability to do that, and we're lucky that we've got a great database to do that, then they will do that themselves, and they're far more motivated to do that than I would say potentially older players, because they are so used to spending time on their phones, whether that's a cultural thing, whether that's a generational thing. I would probably go down that route, but yeah, in terms of like the video is so powerful, because you can't disagree with what everyone's seeing, right? That is what it is. You can synthesize ways of why it might be, but ultimately the camera doesn't lie. So yeah, I think in terms of that Dubai example, a lot of the referees were like, oh, that's
what it looks like. We didn't think that happened. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's amazing how, and look, the camera is obviously a very different angle to the referee's perspective. So we've got to take that into account. And okay, so sometimes the sort of wording or phrasing that we use from the camera angle, this is what we see and this is the expected decision. They and that referee might come back with, from my angle, I saw this. And whether, hopefully that's true, hope that might not be. yeah, it's video and perception, I suppose, is a massive one. And it's, you've got to be really careful in the way you use it, because I think to go down this idea that video is always right, I think is the wrong way of looking. And to go down this idea of players are always right or coaches are always right, there's got to be some sort of middle ground. And I think I would say the better coaches, the better referees, the better players understand that middle ground and understand how to use it. But that comes with time and experience and all that.
It's interesting in that debate is I think an American football player, I think one of the Kelsey brothers, talked about how when pundits like absolutely slam referees for making wrong decisions, when they've slowed down every single thing and slowed down, and they're like, how the hell did they miss that? And then the I think it was Jason Kelsey basically said, well, the referee isn't seeing that. So it definitely highlights that there are biases when you can slow down into every single picture. And that's where you can get into the trap of like absolutely nailing umpires or refs when they are just, when you can work out a better way of doing it and a better way to improve them rather than kind of bash them over the head with video.
Yeah, I think it's where technology is going. Like, I suppose rugby at the moment is in a real tipping point, especially with the way that TMO is happening and the way TMO is being used.
Do you think rugby being used more effective? Sorry for interruption. But do you think
it's more effective
than it is being done in football?
I think we're more used to it.
Okay, interesting.
I obviously football has its own problems, and I will openly say I don't really watch that much football. Okay. But what I do hear about is when VAR goes wrong. Mm-hmm. You don't hear about when VAR has made a great decision. Then that's the reality of how sport works and how we are very emotional people. But I think in rugby, we're more used to seeing video on the big screen. Fans are used to seeing slowed down decisions. And I think we're getting to a point now where we understand the really big positives of TMO, television match officials, in games of rugby. However, I don't think we all agree in terms of stakeholders of the game of how the game should be refereed. Okay. And what I mean by that is there are countless decisions or non-decisions that we look at as referees that we choose to not penalise. However, if you slowed it down on a big screen, well, you probably should penalise it. But in live play, most referees wouldn't look at penalising it because we want to try and make the game flow.
Yeah.
But how do you convince a coach to say, well, we've seen a potential, we've seen an offence. It's categorically, it's an offence. It's an illegal act. But we're not choosing to penalise it because we want the game to flow. And they just, it's a rabbit hole of where the game is with rugby and safety and everything. And ultimately, I think I would like to see World Rugby or someone of that nature, an organization, to start taking a stranglehold of this idea. What should our game look like in the next 5 years? I.e., do we want a game where there's going to be mistakes, it's going to flow really well, but the referee's not going to penalize everything? Or do we want a game that's probably quite stop-starty, that's going to have more penalties, and it's not going to flow as well? But there could be some good rugby in those bits, but it's really hard for the neutral to kind of follow along to the game. And I don't know where it wants to sit. And I would want to sit in the game of flowing nature. But you look at sports like you mentioned, the American sport, like American football, that's got tons of stop starts. Yeah, it's one of the biggest products in the world. So are we shying away from something that doesn't really exist? Could we have more stops and starts, but do something with it? I don't know. It's a rabbit hole. Yeah,
it's a very interesting conversation. But
yeah, I mean, I'm sure there's lots of people who know more about American football than I do. Again, a sport I just don't watch. But it seems like it's doing something right because the game is growing and it's got a massive fan base. So, and rugby doesn't. And rugby, categorically, we know the fan base is diminishing. So we've got
to have problems that need to development.
Yeah, absolutely.
Very interesting point. I didn't realize this podcast was going to go down the route, but I'm very happy. pull it back to cricket. So yeah. Northampton has that history of being a smaller club, but punching up in certain years. So
yeah,
this is before your time, but in previous spells, you've won the Northampton has won the T20 Blast in 2013 and 2016 and reached the final in 2015. My question is, do you think you're still, as a small county, and no disrespect to you or Northampton, but do you think you're more set up to be winning and challenging in competitions in white ball cricket rather than red ball cricket?
Good question. I think
it's a tough one because, as you said earlier, as a lead out and as a county, you have to concentrate on all three formats. You have to play all three formats.
We, of course, would want to compete in all three formats, and I think we have the players to do that. I think that it can be difficult at times, and I think the barriers that we have, as you referenced, being a smaller county, it makes it more challenging because we don't have the luxury of having a bigger squad size and having more bodies to be able to use. Does that mean you can't be successful? No, because otherwise, the Leicester City example, winning the Premier League, that wouldn't exist. So I think it's interesting, like Leicestershire County saying that we want to put more effort into white ball cricket was really interesting. And I think credit to them and being really brave, just to saying, look, that's where we want to be. That's where the money, we're going to get more people, more bums on seats watching cricket. So why don't we do that? I think if you asked head coach and all players, we want to be as successful as we can be. And that reality should be playing Division One cricket and competing in the T20 Blast and the One Day Comp. And I think we absolutely can do that. I don't think we have. I think the challenge becomes is when people believe that we're a small account and we can't do that. Okay. And I think that, and it's a very British way, I would say, of looking at things. Oh, well, we haven't got the big enough wallet, so we can't do it. Well, hang on a minute. Isn't that why you're all here? Because you want to win trophies. You want to win games of cricket. So if you want to come with that attitude, I don't think that attitude is right for us as a club. Mm. We want you to be the best cricketer you can be. You want to be the best cricketer you can be. So let's try and do something and be a part of something. Let's not just be like, oh, well.
We're just here to compete. Well, no, we're just here to participate rather than compete.
Sorry. Exactly. And I think, judging by our history, we can definitely do more than compete. Mm. And I'd like to think that we're building a squad definitely that can absolutely compete. I'd love to say, if we had another conversation, Andrew, at the end of this year, that we've won something or we're getting promoted to Division One back again. Like, I absolutely think that's within our radar. It's and hopefully the lads also believe that as well.
Interesting. Nah, I definitely will. Best of luck to you for the coming up season. Yeah. It's always a bit of, at this point, there's all of these, that speculation and that the training period, and you feel like, right, how can we develop ourselves to be best possible team when it comes to April? In your role, how does your role work in around overseas recruitment in terms of looking at players that you can bring in for the whole season or a section of the season? A section of the season to bolster your squad?
So I think my role has grown and grown since joining Northampton in terms of recruitment. And I think that's twofold, mainly because they trust me more. Mm-hmm. And they understand that I've got a real role to play. And number two, they understand how important data can be to recruitment, because we are the evidence to their decision making. We're not all of decision making, but we are the evidence to why a certain player is signed or not. And so I think this year it's felt really difficult for overseas signings because of the cricket world calendar. And I'm sure I'm not the only one. I get lost in how much cricket there is and who can be there and who can be not and who's available. And we have to think about, number one, who's available, but who could be within our budget. Mm. And that means that probably you could make the assumption that data is far more important to someone like Northamptonshire, because we have to try and find the really good performers who are maybe not noticed or is not bigger names than if you are potentially a county with more money. You could just find a big name and know that, you know what, if you put this amount of money to this name, they probably will win you a couple of games here and there. You don't need to take a look at data to prove that. But I'm really trying to work hard to show the head coach and chief exec, look, this is why I think this player's really good, because they have performed in X, Y categories. They've performed here. They've done this. This is why we should start to have a look at this player and maybe start to find out like where their availability is, but also what sort of money they would be asking for, because there would be loads of players that I might suggest because I think they're unknown, or there'll be loads of players where I think, hang on a minute, they could be a real threat for us here and we could use this skill set, and then they come back and they ask for far too much money that's well out of our budget, like silly money. I would say silly money, but you know, I think overseas recruitment is absolutely where I feel analysts can add a huge amount, because the reality is coaches are not going to watch every ball of cricket. So why should we expect them to know about every ball of cricket? And the data allows us to synthesize that information very quickly and you're trying to put the right people in the right areas, and data can absolutely show you, number one, where those people have performed in the past, and assuming under the laws of kind of common sense that they can at least repeat performance, we can then use that for Northamptonshire. Sometimes they don't, and that's just the way sport happens. That's why sport is exciting. But you'd like to think that they could repeat their performance at least.
And that's one of the interesting things. When I was looking at your 50 over comp and some of your recruitment, that you got in past Indian star Priti Shaw for four games, and he struck a strike rate of 143 with 200s. And a top score of 244, sorry, against Somerset. What was it like for that kind of recruitment? Because he's only there for a small part of the, I don't know how much involvement you had in that recruitment, but that seems like a smart decision, mate, because he isn't in Indian limelight at the moment. He's not in the
Yeah.
He's not in their teams. What was like that to bring him into the squad? And what did he give to the squad in experience, not let alone just his runs?
I mean, Prithvi, how many adjectives could I use to describe how brilliant of a human he is and how brilliant of a cricketer he is? I mean, just, I've never seen anyone strike a ball like he does. And that was a chat in the dressing room, like constantly when he was making that double 100 against Somerset, it was like, right, is he the best cricketer that's ever played on this cricket field? Is he arguably the best opening batter in world cricket at the moment that just no one knows? Like, that's just the aura that he brought. He was just a superstar. And he was so lovely. And it was really good to have him in the dressing room, not only from an obviously performance standpoint. We'd love him to have played more games, but that's the reality of pro sport. Like, we can't wrap him in bubble wrap. He looks like he's doing really well. He's training again for the IPL, for the Delhi Capitals. It looks like that he's back on. So we've signed him again for next year. So hopefully we can see the carnage unfold.
Is that exclusive for the Catch It podcast, or is that already?
No. That's definitely that's out there.
You're giving me an absolute pearl of wisdom.
No, I can't do that because I think otherwise I won't be a Liverpool analyst anymore. But yeah, so we've signed him. Hopefully he'll come end of the in that block where we have a couple of championship games, because he can't play the T20 Blast for obviously BCCI reasons. And then he plays the One Day Cup and we convince him that he stays also for the back end of the championship. Now, who knows? Like, that's the thing with visas, and I think it's an unknown story, that this idea that we can just bring players whenever we want and there's no visa issue, there's no travel issue, there's no injury. Like, there's so many moving parts to getting a human being from one part of the world to the next part of the world to play professional cricket, far more than I realized when I joined Northamptonshire, if I'm being brutally honest. I thought it was quite easy, but like, so he could be brilliant again, as always. And I think someone like that, because he's so lovely about it, it's great. It's not like he's also quite arrogant with it and it's like he's telling blokes how poor they are, how you're not, but like, it's absolutely not. Prithvi is just quiet, calm. Like, for me, it was brilliant because I was traveling with the team, and before every game, he'd literally go, James, can I see the bowlers? Great. First question, any of them quick? And I go, Prithvi, not for you. And then he just walks out there, walks out there and goes on and makes 100 like it's nothing. But those attentions to detail are what probably makes him a star in his own right, because like, he got off the plane from India, went, right, I'm having a hit. Right, okay, I guess we're in. I'm having a hit. I'm just feeling the bat again, going again. He'd turn up for training. He'd even played a couple of second team games. Like, it was bonkers. I think you have moments where you find players like that, where the game is easy for them. Now, we could sit here and argue for hours on end whether it's a talent or it's a genetic or it's a practice thing. But ultimately, he's a genuine star. And, who knows? India might fucking pick him up at this point. Yeah. And we just hope that India haven't realised how good this kid is, because he is still 23. Like, he's younger than myself.
I feel like I've followed the IPL for a good while now. I didn't realise how young he was.
Mate, him and Harry Brook are the same age.
Insane. Bonkers. Absolutely. I don't know the numbers on how long he's been playing. And obviously he's made Indian debuts and stuff, but I didn't know he was that young.
He made his Indian debut at 18. And he scored a test century, I think, on debut.
Incredible. It's
bonkers. And it was against the Pat Cummins, Mitchell Stark era of Australia. Like, serious skill. Even if he played for another four games in the One Day Cup,
that would be useful for him in not just his performance, but his attitude or around.
Even if he was sat there on crutches again and just helped the lads bat, like, I honestly think it would be useful. He was a genuine star, and hopefully we see him again next year.
And that's the challenge of an overseas, and the data, and if they're going to come over and perform similar, but how they fit into your squad. And I think it was interesting to look at some of your, you brought in Sam Whiteman, who has been kind of going through kind of a period of, he kind of flipped between being included in the Sydney Thunder and the Perth Scorchers. He's kind of, he was there, thereabouts, and he's kind of, he's in his 30s now. What influenced your Norfant's decision to pick him up from and bring him over for the fifth year of a comp?
So we're very lucky as ECB account analysts, as you know, Lashie, that we can get access to data from Sheffield Shield, Plunkett Shield and all that. And so I got all the names of every batter overseas. And now this year we've got access to South African domestic data as well. So that's brilliant, right? So the more data we get, the more objective we can be around cricket performance. He was basically one of the best. He's got one of the best averages of Sheffield Shield from the last couple of years before 2022. Left-handed keeper bat, and he'd obviously been a part of the WA squad. He just won the Sheffield Shield. A lot of it married up. He was available, which is a massive one. We had a good character kind of report on him, like he's a good bloke. And we wanted him mainly for our counter champ. And then obviously when you know someone's available for that period of time, you want them to stay for the one day cup. And then he played one game in September and then flew home, and it helped that like he had family back in England and that he could visit during the time that we were playing the T20 Blast. He's playing the Big Bash at the moment for Perth Scorchers. I think data, it was an easy sell because it was very much like, well, he's one of the best batters in terms of batting average, which is our main commodity that we deal with in Red Bull cricket in Australia. I would argue that Sheffield Shield Red Bull cricket is a very good standard or of similar standard to County Championship. Obviously the wickets are a bit different. I think that's something that I didn't realize, but someone like Sam, who's grown up playing on fast bouncy wickets, just loves to sit back. Like when I was coding, you'd code a good length and he'd still be playing a back foot defense. But all these English guys that grow up on, you know, wet April wickets, you're probably going forward defense on the same length. I think that's something that we have to take into account, that look, if what they bring in terms of, and what they're used to in their home conditions. And that's why I think a lot of counties are potentially more reticent to take players from very different conditions to England, because they would presume that they might struggle playing with like swinging seaming balls because they might not have that in their home conditions. So we try and look at Australia, New Zealand, South Africa for overseas for Red Bull cricket a lot of the time because we think their conditions are very similar, especially when they play their cricket, because of the Big Bash, they play their cricket early season and late season. So very similar to like our conditions. So yeah, so someone like Sam, he was very easy to slot in, really nice, humble guy. And obviously a very good cricketer and showed his class, you know, one of the top leading run scorers in the Division One. You know, he did it when it was hard. He had some really good innings. I think he just would have liked a bit more support at times from his teammates. But that's the way it goes. He's loving it. He's just had a baby as well while he was in England. Oh, so
congratulations.
He obviously would love to spend a bit more time at home. And yeah, I'm sure Northants will keep his number in their diary and you never know when he might come back.
I think is that a key thing for Northants as a smaller county, is working out who we can get, who is like a pretty sure, who's a bit out of the limelight now, young, potentially going to come back into it, or a Sam Whiteman who kind of has gone hard and fast as a youngster and then settled a bit more into a really strong domestic cricketer that is also probably not going to be called up for Australia. So that helps your needs. It's finding all those factors. Do they all equate?
Yeah. And I think that's the thing as well. Like we had Lance Morris signed last year and unfortunately didn't make it over. Like we were very shocked that we got him in the first place, but at the same time, it was great that he wanted to come and play County Championship cricket. We signed him for 3 games and it was what we needed. We just needed a bit of extra pace, and we didn't really need data to prove that, if I'm being brutally honest. Like, we didn't need speed guns. We just needed a point of difference because we didn't have that in our attack at that time. And it's just such a shame that he had stress fractures in his back. Like, it's just little things like that where it's just the way of how the game works. But yeah, we try and find those fringe guys who are dominating their domestic scene, who, for whatever reason, aren't on the international radar, who will be available for good stints of time. Because I think that it becomes quite difficult when you've got an overseas who's coming in for four games and then going away, and then we've got another one coming in for another four. Like, I think from a culture standpoint and like a dressing room feeling, I think it makes more sense if you've got guys, right, this player is coming for this block of six to eight games, and we have him for that period, and then they feel more at home, they feel more a sense of belonging, the players gravitate to them more, they become part of the team more, and that's a massive thing, I think, for overseas. I think it's different if you're like a franchise team, right, and you're going for a month, and you might know loads of other guys because you played in South Africa with them, and then Dubai, and then whatever. But I think for us, because we've got longer seasons and we're more of a club feel, being a part of that team is quite a massive one. So we try and get players who are more available. There might be better players available at times, but only for one or two games. But we'd rather go for the guy that is there for more longer periods of time.
And can slot into your culture.
Exactly.
Your team is better.
Yes. And all those things we don't quantify as analysts. Mm. But coaches feel, players feel, and are emotive. So we've got to try and work how to bring that all in together.
To work out how to actually pull those two together, whereas how they fit in more the kind of cultural, the club, the dressing room, and how their actual performance data is going to match up.
Absolutely.
So going on to the next stage, what do you think is the future for a lead analyst? For yourself, in terms of, are you touring this winter? Have you got stuff kind of working on how you're going to develop in the winter? What is the next kind of couple of months look like for you?
I think for me, it's all around getting the information in the right hands. And when I say that, I mean, so a lot of it is recruitment stuff and making sure that people are very clear on where players' performances are and where they have been and really engaging the coaches to a level that they, number one, get the information, but number two, know what that information means. So things like creating ways of appraising players during the season so we can make more informed decisions, and it's not just feel like, okay, well, they were good last year, and it's kind of, well, they haven't really very good start this year, okay, we're gonna need to start changing things. And actually it's going, no, they were kind of here at the start of the year, they are now here, might not need to change as much as you think, but it's just because they're quite emotional and it might be due to results or whatever that they might want to start changing lots of things. So I think for me, that's what I'm really trying to work on, is getting that information in coaches' eyes and finding really efficient ways to do that. And that usually means for me at the moment is setting up Tableau dashboards so that it's very seamless and it's very easy for the coaches to see the information. And that takes time. Like, I would say that a good dashboard for me now takes around a season, because it will start in the winter and I'll start creating it and conceptualizing it and understanding, right, this is what the dashboard needs to answer in terms of questions. Then I've got to put it to the coaches and basically break it. It's almost like product design, right? Break the product, see where it's really poor or where it needs to improve, and then go back to drawing board, try and make all those changes, go again back to them. And then when you'll feel comfortable that you know that they're comfortable looking at that dashboard, right, then giving it to them when they need it. And knowing when they need it is really tricky. Because sometimes you might mistime it. Sometimes it's not the right time at the wrong place. And then the information gets lost in the ether of lots of other information that's in their heads around decision making. But if you can get the right information at the right time, it's so powerful. And they go, oh, right, I didn't realize that. Okay, that might change my thoughts and perceptions around this player or this strategy or this decision. And for me as the analyst, like, I'm not the one that's held accountable for decisions. No one's putting my head on the chopping block. So I've got to give the people that are accountable for those decisions the best information as possible or the most information as possible. So for me, that's what I'm really trying to work on in the next 2 months. I'd love to say that I'm going to a franchise league at some point. I'd love to say that I'm signing some winter sun. But that's not on the horizon anytime soon. But that's okay. That's part of my own professional development. I've got to try and work out a way to worm that in. But yeah, it's also like a nice time to chill out and just plan and kind of take stock and go again, reset the batteries in the most kind of cliche way, and get ready for the 1st of April, because that's when the real fun starts.
As you said, in terms of this block, you have that structure to reflect, and it's quite nice. This has probably been the first winter for myself that I've been in 3 days a week using full track with our women, and kind of having those off days to work on like tableau skills and stuff. So it's quite nice because it's different, but it's still busy, but it's a different kind of busy.
Yeah, it's I think what's mad is if you said to people, analysts weren't really full-time roles maybe 2-3 years ago at times, people go, what? And actually the winter is a really important way of making sure that your analyst then provides use and actual value in the summer. Because if they just worked in the summer to summer, all they're probably doing is coding and a bit of data. They don't have the time to work on the information that you're giving them, because there's so many games of cricket that you want them to code, because that's their main job role. And so it's really nice to hear examples like yourself, Lushy, and also around the counter of going, no, I'm a full-time analyst now. I have time in the winter to actually get better at my job and improve, and not just be a putting out fires from April to October and then I just do nothing for the winter and go again. So yeah, I think that's where cricket's really, it's got better, because I think people have worked out that that's what needs to happen. Do I think it's fixed? No.
But we could talk many different points that we think analysis would be better. But that's, that's definitely for an in-person gripe when we meet at the analyst conference in February.
That's a different conversation. But yes, I think it's really nice to say that I do go in 3 days a week, sometimes less than that. And that's quite nice as well, because I quite enjoy working from home and I can really sit and get arguably lost in the data and work and really break things and then go again. And then I'm much better for it, because if I turn up, so for example, I've been in 2 days this week, haven't chosen to go in today because there's no real players about and there's no real meetings, there's no need for me. But this next 2 days is really important for me to try and create a new dashboard, so that when I go back in on Monday, I've got, right, guys, I've been working on this for the last 3 days. I think this could really help us here. They then look at it and they either absolutely throw it away or they go, no, I really like that. Could you change these things about it? And then we go again. And that's part of the process. Like, I think to think that you just walk into a professional sporting institution and go, yeah, I'm an analyst, I just do my job in it.
It's not working more about like that anymore. There is more that hybrid, being able to work at home with that data skills and to be able to. And that's where I hope the majority of coaches and directors of cricket are realizing that it's not just when we turn up to a game and collect the data, it's how we work with those processes. And I'm sure you're seeing that as well.
Absolutely. And it will only get better over time, the more analysts we get put into those roles and actually showing them this is what it's about and this is where it can really provide value. I think we're at a bit of a, not tipping point, I think that's far too big, but it's like I think there are obviously counties that we know, because we're in the industry at the moment, that are using data really well and really are getting on board with why analysts and analysis is really important to their workflow and how their organization works. And there are obviously some counties that I think that I look from the outside in and go, not sure about that one. Do I think that to be successful as a cricket county you need a good analyst? I think I'd be stupid to say no, but I think there are also lots of behaviors in professional cricket that are just done because they're done. And I think that sometimes an outside source, a new analyst, a new person, a fresh face might really benefit that organization. But I'm not on the inside of every organization. But yeah, I think we look at it now and I think there are obviously some really good counties. And I'd like to say that maybe in the near future we could add more to that list of counties that really do buy into this analysis. And maybe it's just recruitment. Maybe that's where it's all going, because they're seeing these franchise gigs coming up and they're seeing all this money. And you know what? If we're spending 50 grand on a player, we don't want to not look at the data. Like, let's be really clear here. If you're spending that amount of money and you went, yeah, I just didn't look at the data. I just thought, yeah, I thought it would be good.
It's a risky strategy for a
Come on now. You set yourself up for failure. So I think that's where it's really going and moving to, at least. And look, do I think that analysts have a massive impact in during the game and making real impact in decision making? I would say probably we're on the no side of that spectrum, but I think only over time, the more players get used to seeing data and using data, do I think it might change.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much, James. This has been a really great chat.
You're good, mate. Loved it.
This is giving me many, I think we could go on for another hour, but we'll have to cut it there. Thank you very much for coming on the Catch Up Podcast.
No worries, mate.
And thank you very much for your time.
Cheers, buddy. Great to see you.